Continuing the chapter on Atamayata, and the end of the reading yesterday was Atamayata in practice. So and this unusual word, or not very commonly known word, means not made of that, and it refers to one of the most refined attributes of wisdom, or awakened awareness in Buddha Dhamma. So to continue. The references to Atamayata in the Pali Canon are few. Here are the two above quoted passages from the Majjhima Nikaya as examples. So in the long article by Santikaro Bhikkhu, he referred to a couple of passages from the Majjhima that illustrated this quality, and so these are the full quotes from the Pali Canon. The first one is from Majjhima Sutta 113. It's called the Saparisa Sutta, or the Discourse on What is a Good Person. A person who is not truly good enters and remains in the first jhana. They notice, I have gained the attainment of first jhana. They exalt themselves for that attainment of first jhana, and they disparage others. This is the quality of a person who is not truly good. The truly good person notices, the Blessed One has spoken of non-identification, non-fabrication, even with regard to the attainment of the first jhana. For, however they conceive it, the fact is ever other than that. So, making non-identification their focal point, they neither exalt themselves for that attainment of the first jhana, nor do they disparage others. This is the quality of a person who is truly good. And similarly through all of the jhanas. The clause italicized above, which you can't all see, but was yena yena, was the passage, for however they conceive it, the fact is ever other than that. That clause is very famous and much discussed phrase in the Theravada literature. It appears in a number of places in the canon. The Pali original is yena yena hi manyanti tatotanghoti anyatati. It's discussed extensively in Concept and Reality by Bhikkhu Nyanananda, and has also been quoted earlier in this book in chapter 4. And then the second passage, I'll add an extra paragraph onto what we have here, which is from Sutta 137, which is called the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition on the sixfold base. So we didn't include this other paragraph at the start of that quote, but I'll add it in here because it is relevant to what we were looking at yesterday. And what, bhikkhus, is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity? There is equanimity regarding forms, sounds, odors, flavors, and tangibles. This, bhikkhus, is equanimity that is diversified based on diversity. And the rest of the quote, just to carry on with that. And what, bhikkhus, is equanimity that is unified based on unity? There is equanimity regarding the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of no-thingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This, bhikkhus, is equanimity that is unified, based on unity. Here, bhikkhus, by depending and relying on equanimity that is unified, based on unity, abandon and surmount equanimity that is diversified, based on diversity. It is thus this is abandoned, it is thus this is surmounted. Bhikkhus, by depending and relying on non-identification, that's Atamayata, abandon and surmount equanimity that is unified, based on unity. It is thus this is abandoned, it is thus this is surmounted. So, it was in reference to this that it was said, therein, by depending on this, abandon that. So, just reiterating briefly what I was saying yesterday, the sort of three stages of equanimity, or that quality of centeredness, serenity. The first sort of stage one, as I would describe it, is there is stillness in the middle of all that stuff. And then the second level is there is the relationship of subject and object, a knower and a known, but the quality of wisdom is such that the mind isn't getting drawn into the diversity or multiplicity of different sense objects, but rather there's just a sense of, oh, that's the conditioned realm, or that's the field of experience. There is equanimity in the mode of subject knowing an object. And then the third level, being still in the presence of that as a unified presence. And then the third level, Atamayata, is there is no that. To help develop a clearer sense of what this term is pointing to, it might be helpful to explore its etymology a little more deeply. And this is a passage from the very interesting little book by Richard Gombrich, who was a professor of Pali and Sanskrit at Oriel College, Oxford University, the main Sanskrit professor for the university. It's called Metaphor, Allegory and Satire, a chapter in the book called How Buddhism Began, The Conditioned Genesis of the Early Teachings. I believe we have a copy in the library here, and it's very well worth reading. So this is from Richard Gombrich's comments in Metaphor, Allegory and Satire. In the Vedanta, to be wholly and exclusively aware of Brahman, i.e. ultimate reality, was at the same time to be Brahman. The origins of this idea seem to lie in a theory of sense perception in which the grasping hand supplies a dominant analogy. It takes the shape of what it apprehends. So when you pick up something, like a glass, the hand takes the shape of the glass. That's what it's picking up. So that's what he means by a grasping hand configures itself to the thing that it's grasping. That's the image. It takes the shape of what it apprehends. Vision was similarly explained. The eye sends out some kind of ray, which takes the shape of what we see and then comes back with it. Similarly, thought. A thought conforms to its object. The idea is encapsulated in the term tanmayata, that's the Pali, consisting of that the thought of the Gnostic or meditator becomes consubstantial with the thing realized. So this kind of energy goes out, occupies an object like a recording device, a microphone, a person, a room, a thought, goes out, occupies that, and then having occupied that shape, then it brings it back, and that's what is perceived or known. That was the concept or the understanding of the nature of perception in the Vedic philosophy, and would be in the field of understanding and the sort of philosophical landscape of the Buddha's time. So consubstantial means connecting together with or in of the same substance, unified in substance. Does that make sense? Atamayata is not going out and getting lost in and becoming consubstantial with the object. So that the term atamayata is somewhat related to that philosophical structure that was around in the Buddha's time. So then I go on to explain. That is to say, with the opposite quality, atamayata, the mind's energy, quote-unquote, does not go out to the object and occupy it. It neither makes an objective thing or a subjective observer, quote-unquote, knowing it. Hence, non-identification, quote-unquote, refers to the subjective aspect, and non-fabrication mostly to the objective. The different translations for the term atamayata, Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhikkhu Nyanamoli, in this book they have it as non-identification. Ajahn Tanisro translates it as non-fashioning. And Ajahn Santikaro translated as unconcoctability. So that, again, there's various ways you can read it, but non-identification is, to me, it's talking about the subject side, a sense of a me who's doing the experiencing, or non-fashioning, not making a that, or not concocting a sense of solidity in what is perceived, seen, heard, smelt, tasted, or touched, or thought about. The reader should also carefully bear in mind the words, quote, the origins of this idea, unquote, and not take the Vedic concept and imagery as representing the Buddhist use of the word as being entirely accurate. In the state of atamayata, in its Buddhist usage, there is no actual becoming consubstantial with the thing that's being known. It's more that the deluded identification of the mind with the object is being dispelled. So what that is to say is that the Buddha's using that term, like the energy not going out and unifying with the object and coming back, because that was the way that perception was understood in his time, but it's not trying to say that's actually the way that perception works. Does that make sense? The Buddha wasn't replicating exactly the same idea of the Vedas, but was using that kind of language. And so it's quite common in the teachings, depending on who the Buddha was speaking to, he would use the kind of language or symbols or similes that related to that individual person's background. So I think a little while ago, when I was quoting the Bahia Sutta, because Bahia was an ascetic from the bark-clad wearing yogis, wanderers. They wore robes or clothing made of tree bark. And for them, there's a particular passages from the Vedas or Upanishads were significant and important to them. It seems that the language that the Buddha used in speaking to Bahia was a kind of a riff upon some of the teachings that were central to those bark-wearing ascetics. Or when he was talking to a farmer, he would talk about looking after cows, or he was talking to a soldier, he'd talk about the parts of a chariot and use as kind of similes, or speaking to a Brahmin who believed in purification through ritual bathing, he'd talk about water and so on. So the Buddha was frequently drawing upon the social and philosophical landscape and symbols that were around at his time and using that to express his understanding, his teaching. So any questions, thoughts on all of that? Please don't be shy. I'm not trying to dazzle you all with philosophy. The point is that these words are useful to us. So anything that would benefit from being clarified, or any questions that arise? Okay. Any comments from you, Lumpur, on that? What I've been saying? I mean, just because I'm saying it doesn't mean to say I assume it's everything that can or should be said.
One of the things that came to mind, because you were picking out those quotes where it's explicitly mentioned, but I was also thinking back to Ajahn Tinisaro's book, The Wings to Awakening. He goes through the stages of Satipatthana, and then the last stage of Satipatthana, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world, he equates with Atamyata.
Oh, right. I didn't. Yeah. Oh, it's been a long time since I read that.
Yeah, it's just.
Yeah, I've forgotten it. If I had noted that at the time, I'd forgotten it.
No. Uh-huh. It was something that he sort of pointed out, and I'm not sure where he. You know, it's probably some commentary or treatise somewhere he knew about that equator.
And when Santikara highlighted the fact that you can't find the word Atamayatara in the Pali Text Society dictionary, I would say, well, that was put together in the 1890s, so it was very early years of Buddhist studies, and so that quite a lot of things were overlooked, and it's not absolutely sort of thorough and watertight in its representation of all of the significant words in the Pali canon. It is an amazing piece of scholarship, but it's by no means completely thorough in every respect. And I think Ajahn Tinisaro probably had access to a few Thai dictionaries and Thai commentaries as well.
Yes, this is true.
Okay, so to continue. One helpful way of understanding Atamayata's role and significance is to relate it to the other two items in the final triad of the nine insights, as outlined by Ajahn Buddhadasa. These three qualities describe the upper reaches of spiritual refinement: sunyata, voidness or emptiness; tatata, thusness or suchness; atamayata, non-identification or not thatness. The three qualities speak to the nature of experience when many of the coarser defilements have fallen away. When the qualities of emptiness and suchness are considered, even though the conceit of identity might already have been seen through, there can still remain subtle traces of clinging to the idea of an objective world being known by a subjective knowing, even though no sense of I is discernible at all. There can be the feeling of a this, which is knowing a that, and either saying yes to it in the case of suchness, or no, in the case of emptiness. Say, as I was mentioning yesterday, that saying yes in terms of suchness, or saying yes to Dhamma, or in terms of tatata, or no to the five khandhas, no, you're not solid, you're not real, you're empty, with respect to the conditioned realm and the five khandhas. Atamayata is the closure of that whole domain, expressing the insight that there is no that. It is a genuine collapse of both the illusion of separateness of subject and object, and also of the discrimination between phenomena as being somehow substantially different from each other. As it has been written, and this is a quote from a northern Buddhist tradition, the verses of the third Chan patriarch, the Sinsin Ming, the verses on the faith mind: do not remain in the dualistic state. Avoid such pursuits carefully. If there is even a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Of the 10 obstacles or fetters, Sanyojana, that stand in the way of enlightenment, the penultimate, the next to last, is Udaccha, restlessness. So the last three, somewhat referring to in the previous paragraph, was Asmimana is the conceit of identity. That's fetter number 8. Fetter number 9 is Udaccha. And number 10 is Avijja, or ignorance. So the penultimate fetter is Udaccha, restlessness. In this light, we can reflect that Atamayata represents the overcoming of this ninth fetter. The restlessness to which this refers is not the fidgeting of the uncomfortable meditator. It is the subtlest of feelings that there might be something better over there, or just in the future, a feeling that that, quote unquote, which is just out of reach, might have more value in some way than this, quote unquote. It is the ever so insidious addiction to time and its promises. This is why Ajahn Chah would say such things as, a samana, a religious seeker, has no future. Furthermore, if there is no that, quote unquote, then the nature of this, quote unquote, must necessarily be reformulated, so that we're not just left with a subject devoid of its object. Again, I appreciate it's a little bit abstruse, maybe difficult to follow, but I do feel this is helpful to contemplate. Udaccha is about time and location, that the Dhamma is timeless, unlocated. There isn't a future or a past in terms of Dhamma. It's only when there's the identification or attachment, mind buying into the conditioned realm, that time and three-dimensional space, location, apply. Essentially, in the world of mind, place doesn't apply. You can't say, my mind stops here and yours begins there. You know, there-ness doesn't really apply in the realm of mind. It only really applies, I would say, in the terms of rupakanda, the material world. Udaccha, even though the sense of asmi, the I am feeling, might have been let go of, the mind can still create structures of time and location, that there's another place or another time over there, or just off in the future, or some other place is somehow more real or different or other than this, so that it's a way of talking about the mind's not fully in tune with its own nature as Dhamma, without fully realizing Dhamma. Restlessness, the word tends to bring to mind kind of fidgeting or uncomfortable, I want to go and live somewhere else. But this is a very subtle kind of restlessness in meditation, that sense of, oh, something that's really, really good is about to happen, or my mind is heading in a good direction. So in a way, it's saying direction. How could Dhamma not be absolutely here and now? It's not about somewhere else, some other time, just in a few moments, or just over there in a different way. Even though it's a quite a refined level of realization, obviously it's extremely subtle, but just being able to use that as a way of recognizing those movements of the mind, certainly in my experience of meditation, has been a lot of, ooh, you know, something that was good is just gone, or something that's good is just over there, or just in a few moments, or ooh, heading for things, or trying to lean into the next moment, or hang on to the one that's just gone, is a very, very common mental habit. And so just to be able to name, well, this is Udaccha, this is the mind creating another place, another time. Is that real? Is that solid? Is that substantial? And so it's a way of highlighting that habit, that kind of delusional framework, and thereby, by it being highlighted, it can be let go of. So even though it's a very refined level of insight and realization, it doesn't mean it's not very worthy or very useful on a practical level, just as we carry out our meditation in sitting, walking, and these times that we have during this winter retreat period, lots of opportunity for formal practice to be employing that. And I've certainly found a lot of a benefit just contemplating that sense of location. And in a later chapter, I think chapter 9, we talk about the unconditioned and non-locality. Just how completely unconscious the sense of here-ness can be. You know, here as opposed to there, that everything is happening here. It's a subtle attachment, but it can be something that really obstructs that, the kind of the brightness and freedom of the heart. I remember years ago, one of the very quiet early days of Umayagiri, particularly in the wintertime when it was very rainy. How many inches of rain have they had so far this year?
65 inches.
So there are 65 inches of rain this year so far. That's more than 5 feet of rain. So the average rainfall for the UK per year is about 22 inches. So it's very rainy winters, Umayagiri. In the early days, we get very, very few visitors. So winter retreat time was extremely quiet. And I remember maybe the third or fourth year we were there, about so 99 or 2000, and one of those rainy winters and very, very quiet and solid routine of practice. So because of very few visitors, very few interactions, so my mind was quite quiet. And I began to notice how, even though it seemed to be pretty clear that there was no sense of self around seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, there was still some kind of blockage or tightness or obstruction. And I thought, what is this? This is really, there's something that seems to be creating a sense of limitation or a stressing, a tensing in the citta. But it didn't seem to have any I or me or mine associated with it. And digging into this, I remember about 3 or 4 days, this is really curious. And then there was a sense of, oh, it's happening here. This is being known here. It hadn't ever really dawned in the past that, oh, that sense of here-ness as opposed to there, that sense of locatedness was never something that I'd noticed. It was so subtle, like, you know, the air that's breathable or the force of gravity that's here all the time, so we forget it, we miss it, we don't notice it. Oh, right. I found that was very, very valuable. Just to highlight that, even with a simple phrase like, it's all being known here, or this is known here, or just here, to illuminate that presumption that the mind is making, and then creating the conditions for that to be let go of.
Ajahn?
Yes?
I have two questions regarding the fetters. Is it correct that if the conceit I am is penetrated, the others dissolve, it essentially eliminates the other four? Because I thought I'd heard that. If conceit is seen or known, or is that not true?
I'd be very interested to hear what Lumpo Pasanga has to say. But sometimes the phraseology of the Buddha is like in the Meghya Sutta, where he says, to be free of the conceit I am, that is Nibbana here and now. Or to be free of conceit of I am, that is the highest happiness. I feel it's a form of expression of bundling all those last three, Asmimana, Udaccha, and Avijja. Sort of, it's a convenient way of bundling those three together. That's how I would.
I would say it. So, yeah.
It's just because oftentimes the Buddha is a shorthand.
Crack one nut, you get them all.
And then the second question is: the same is said if Sakkayadipti is seen or penetrated, then doubt and the other two follow.
It's not a fixed thing. Like I've just been saying, it can be the Asmimana, if you sort of tease them apart, the Asmimana can be dropped, but there's still, Udaccha and Avijja still need to be penetrated. It can be that when the Buddha's speaking about it, that for convenience is bundling all those three together. With respect to the first three fetters, Sakkayaditti and then Vichikicca, Siddhapatta Paramasa, I would say it's not automatic just with self-view, Sakkayaditti is let go of. It's not automatically the case that doubt and the attachment to conventions go at exactly the same time. I don't know, what would you say on that?
Well, absolutely, in the sense that it's possible, but it's not. Everything is uncertain. Because we want it all neat and tidy and wrap it up and make sure that, oh, that's how it works. Because also in the same way that just having insight into one of the three characteristics is oftentimes a catalyst for an insight into the other two. So, but not necessarily so. It could be, can be.
That's a very good example. Often the insight into anicca is used to characterize stream entry. Like Kandanya, what did Kandanya know? Yankinchi samudaya damang sabantang nirodha damanti. The way that the realization of stream entry is characterized as just knowing anicca. that's in a sense, if anicca is known and dukkha is like kind of putting all those things together, it's not just that, but it's a way of expressing. Just in terms of giving meditation instruction and running retreats, very, very regularly people will say, I can understand, I get a feeling for anicca and dukkha, and I can see how even happiness and blissful feelings can be dukkha, but anatta, I'm lost. I have no clue what that's talking about. So that's quite commonly the experience of people. The concept of it is mysterious. And it can be that they do understand anatta better than they realize. But often it's the case that those first two, anicca and dukkha, are far more tangible and apparent. And then anatta, how all things could be not self, that's sort of mysterious or confusing, or the idea is really intangible and hard to get a sense of what that is or how that works. Yes?
How does atamiyata relate to Ajahn Chah's simile about oil and water, the mind and the mind objects being separate? Because I can think of several relations, but I'd be interested to hear your comments on that.
I think it's a very, very skillful and helpful way of talking about letting go. But I would say, you know, atamayata is also representing a quality of the more profound insight that Ajahn Chah expresses, where he says, inside is Dhamma, outside is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma. So the oil is Dhamma, the water is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma. That which is knowing the oil and water is also Dhamma. So it's like, in terms of the initial disentangling or letting go of the habits of identification. But I feel that kind of insight, where Lumpur says, inside is Dhamma, outside is Dhamma, everything is Dhamma, and that which is knowing this is Dhamma also, that it's a kind of extra layer or level beyond the oil and water symbol. All symbols and similes are partially relevant. All analogies are partial. And it's good to bear that in mind. That's how I would read it. I don't know if you'd have any.
Yeah, absolutely. You get these wonderful similes, but then you realize that you can always add some other either interpretation or insight or doubt to it.
You say, well, if that works, then what about such and such? Any kind of simile or metaphor that one uses, there's always a few caveats, you know, or just kind of conditions around it. Okay, so to continue. Atamayata is the utter abandonment of this root delusion. One sees that in ultimate truth there is no time, no self, no here and no there. So rather than be here now, quote-unquote, not with mission to insult Ram Dass, but rather than be here now as a spiritual exhortation, perhaps instead we should say, let go of identity, space and time, or realize unlocated, timeless selflessness, quote-unquote. Needless to say, the conceptual mind falls flat when trying to conjure up an image for such a reality, but that is to be expected. We are consciously leaving the realm of the conceivable, and the purpose of this book is to provide something of a map for those regions where the buses of reason and imagination do not run. You can follow that metaphor, out where the buses do not run. Ajahn Siddhanta was I forget which movie it was. There was some science fiction movie. Ajahn Siddhanta was one of the senior monks from Abhayagiri. And there was, it might have been a Werner Herzog movie, but anyway, somewhere in the movie, it was a kind of a science fiction drama, and a certain group of people were trying to escape from the authoritarian rulers or controllers. And there's this message that comes through to the group that is making the escape. You are leaving the zone of control. As I recall it, and Ajahn Siddhanta was prone to quoting that, you are leaving the zone of control, like you're getting outside the bubble of conceivability and predictability, departing from the zone of control and describability. And this is a very frequent theme of Lumpur Sumato's Dhamma talks these days. He often talks about, try to imagine timelessness, or try to imagine the unconditioned. You can't. He said, my mind goes blank. It's unimaginable. And so I really appreciate how regularly Lumpur Sumato goes to that area where the buses don't run and saying, there really isn't a map out here. Maybe it's more accurate to say this book aims to be a map of how to get to that border. that approach to these areas of realization can be described, but also helping us to realize that beyond that border, that's where that domain, if you can use that word, the ayatana of the unconditioned, the unformed, this is really the essence, the heart of the teachings, or the purpose of the teachings, even though it is unimaginable, indescribable, it can't be conceived. Also, that expression, the conceptual mind falls flat, I borrowed that from Ajahn Buddhadasa. That's an expression he uses in one or two of his books in that same kind of sense, that when you're trying to speak about or refer to the unformed, the unconditioned, the unborn, then it's natural for the conceptual mind to run out of material to represent that. It's also quite possible that on reading these passages on atamayata, the mind wants to grasp it as, quote, something to get so that I won't be so deluded, unquote, rather than seeing it as a restraining of the habitual outward movement of the mind that comes as a result of disenchantment and dispassion. It's always necessary to be aware that ignorance causes even the means of transcendence to become an obstacle if the mind does not handle it wisely. So what this paragraph is talking about is, we can hear these words, and go, oh, this atamayata, this is great stuff, yeah, how can I get that? Or if I've got that, if I've realized that, then all my troubles will be over. And so then the idea or the skillful means whereby that might be actualized is sort of picked up and turned into a thing that I am doing to get somewhere else, so I can be something else. And so unconsciously bolstering the sense of an I who isn't enlightened, who's got to get something to become enlightened at some other time, some other place. And so that's why I use that phrase, ignorance causes even the means of transcendence to become an obstacle. So that the way the mind grasps meditation practices, spiritual teachings, insights, you know, you can have a very clear and valid realization, and then the mind grasps hold of the memory or the idea of it, and then that very grasping of the idea or the memory then becomes an obstacle. That's frequently the case in spiritual life. I think when we were having a coffee with Gompor a couple of days ago, that came up in our discussions. Yes.
It reminds me of the term attainment, the kind of misnomer, really, because there's nothing to attain, because it presupposes this separation with, and maybe realization is more fitting.
Yeah, and if you listen carefully, Lumpo Samhita almost never uses the word attainment. Realization, you know, from time to time, but for exactly that kind of reason. The spiritual attainments, you can almost feel Lumpo kind of recoil if that comes into the conversation. To continue. Perhaps one of the simplest, clearest and most practical expressions of the principle of atamayata, not made of thatness, has come down to us from the teachings of Lumpu Dun, a direct disciple of Venerable Ajahn Mun and one of the great lights of Dhamma in Asia in recent years. So he was a very revered forest monk in Thailand. Here is his reformulation of the Four Noble Truths based on the depiction of ignorance, avicca, as the fundamental error of the mind attempting to go out, quote-unquote, and pursue thatness in the form of perceptions, feelings and ideas. In reflecting on these four formulae, it might be helpful to recollect the analogy of the grasping hand mentioned earlier in this chapter, reaching out to become consubstantial with its object and then returning with it. Lumpu Dun is famous for many reasons, and there's a very substantial collection of his teachings put together by one of his disciples, translated into English, that's available. I think it's Gifts That He Left Behind.
Gifts He Left Behind.
Ajahn Tanisra has got a translation as well. He rejigs the Four Noble Truths. Instead of going 1, 2, 3, 4, dukkha, origin, cessation of dukkha, and path, he reorders it into a more natural time sequence, origin, dukkha, path, cessation. So it goes from 1, 2, 3, 4 to 2, 1, 4, 3, if you can follow that. So, firstly, the mind that goes out in order to satisfy its moods is the cause of suffering. Then, the result that comes from the mind going out in order to satisfy its moods is suffering. And the third one, the mind, seeing the mind clearly, is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And then the fourth one, the result of the mind seeing the mind clearly is the cessation of suffering. And that's from Atulo, the larger collection of his teachings. Gifts He Left Behind is a smaller collection. I think Ajahn Tanisro did the translation?
He did the translation. Yeah.
And then this other one, Bodhinandamuni, put together this much bigger collection called Atulo, which was Lumpudun's Pali name. So it goes 2, 1, 4, 3, cause of dukkha, dukkha, path to the cessation, and then the cessation of dukkha. Lumpur Sumedho was so fond of that. That was, I think, inscribed on a plaque and installed at his kutia at Wat Ratanawan in Thailand. I'm not sure who made it for him. That was referred to it and reflected on it a lot. Did you ever meet Lumpur Dun?
I did, yeah. First time I met him, he brought a group of lay people. He's quite elderly. Came to Wat Nana Chat, and it was very awkward. Because I hadn't been the abbot of Wat Nana Chat that long. And his lay people wanted me to give a Dhamma talk. And it's kind of like, you've got this great monk, why are you asking me to give a Dhamma talk? And finally, Lumpur Dun, get up on the seat. You know. And give the Dhamma talk. And then he invited me a couple times after that to go down to his monastery.
It's in Surin?
Surin, yeah. To sort of give Dhamma talks.
I possibly met him, I'm not sure, at Ajahn Tui's monastery?
I doubt it. Ajahn Tui's.
He was up in Sukhonakorn. Somebody said it was Lumpur Dun. He was very, very quiet. He had round glasses. He was very elderly. Didn't he? Was just,
yeah, I mean, he certainly would have been elderly by then. But he passed away early 1980s.
Oh yeah, then it couldn't have been. I think they must have been mistaken. Yeah. But maybe he looked like Lumpur Dun and said, "Did you pay respects to
Lumpur?" Maybe like mid 1980s.
Yeah, it would have been a mistake then. If it had been him, I would have thought Lumpur Tui would have invited him to give a Dhamma talk. He was this very elderly monk who was staying in that place. I was there for a couple of weeks, and it looked like in his late 80s or 90s, and somebody said it was Lumpur Dun, but he was hardly uttered a word, and just sort of quietly sitting there, sort of radiantly peaceful and bright. But
That fits Lumpur Dun.
Anyway, so he's also, his monastery in Surin, when it was established, it was outside of the town. Then the town spread, as many Thai towns have done, until his monastery was kind of within the city of Surin, I understand now. And they have a big elephant.
Near the exhibition ground.
Near the elephant festival.
Yeah, right where the elephant festival happens.
People were asking me, your monastery is in this really noisy place. You have this huge festival that happens every year. And you're forest monks. Why don't you want to be in a peaceful, quiet place? And very similar to Lumpur Cha's teachings about noise, he said, the noise that comes from the town, it's just minding its own business. Why do you go out and bother it? You know, if you don't go out and upset the noise, it won't bother you. And, or words to that effect. So, to continue. Next, we have some words from Bhikkhu Nyanananda, picking up a variety of terms related to Atamayata. Each of the words he outlines is worthy of a pause to consider and to contemplate its implications. And so this is from Venerable Nyanananda's very fine little book called The Magic of the Mind. It's a very small, thin little Dhamma book, The Magic of the Mind, and it's a commentary on a very short sutta called the Kalakarama Sutta, that I'll quote in a minute. Like concept and reality, it's very, very clear, very helpful, very practical teachings, and very skillful scholarship as well. So this is Venerable Nyanananda, who's a Sri Lankan elder, who wrote this. His English is extremely good as well. The process of becoming is thus shown to be perpetually going on within the mind of the samsaric individual who identifies himself with sense data under the proliferating tendencies towards craving, conceits, and views. The three main asava. These are more usually referred to as the papancha dhammas. This identification is implied by the term tammayata, literally of thatness. And one who resorts to it is called tammayo, one who is made of that, or of that stuff. Since the perpetual process of becoming in the psychological realm is necessarily followed by birth, decay and death, sorrow, lamentation, grief and despair, in every specific instance of short-lived identification, an insight into the law of dependent arising provides one with the key to the entire gamut of samsaric experience. The penetrative insight into the arising and cessation of phenomena dispels all doubts as to the speculative problems of absolute existence and non-existence, of unity and plurality, etc. The mind is brought to rest in the middle, quote-unquote, though, paradoxically, it now rests on nothing. Thingness, quote-unquote, has completely faded away, so much so that craving finds no thing to grasp at. Instead of an attempt at identification, tammayata, impelled by craving, a detached contemplation of the norm of suchness, tatata, sets in. With this emancipation of the mind, one's attitude towards the world, with all its vicissitudes, becomes one of such-likeness, tadita, of aloofness, atamayata, another translation for atamayata, aloofness, and he deserves to be called the such-one, or the such-like-one, tadi, or tadiso in Pali. And then a quote from the Sutta, "The ardent one who touched the destruction of birth by overcoming Mara, by vanquishing the ender, that wise sage, the such-like one, the knower of the world, is unattached, atamayo, in regard to all phenomena." And for those who are interested, the Pali of that is pasaya marang abibhuya antakang yopusi jatikayang patanava so tadiso lokavitu sumeto sabesu tamesu atamayo muni. That's the four-line verse. The discourse he is commenting on, the Kalakarama Sutta, is very brief, although highly potent. So before I go on to that, there's a lot in a few short paragraphs, but I feel he's very insightfully addressing that area and talking about when the mind is caught up in sense objects, in identifying and believing in thoughts and opinions and giving value to sight, sound, smell, taste, touch and so forth, then the mind becomes tamayata, you know, of that, is identified with that, made of that, tamayo, and that when that's been let go of, or there is that quality of atamayata has been actualized, then the nature of the mind can be described as tadi or tadiso, a such-like one, like the word Tathagata that the Buddha used to refer to his own nature, that suchness or such-likeness, the such-one, tadita, tadi and tadiso, those are all words that are referring to the mind free of those kind of identifications and fabrications. Maybe I'll just finish with the Kalakarama Sutta, and that'll be enough for today. So this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Numerical Discourses, Book of the Fours, Sutta number 24. At one time, the Blessed One was staying at Saketa in Kalaka's monastery. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, in this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, among its population of recluses and Brahmins, gods and humans, whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after and pondered over by the mind, all that do I know. Whatsoever is seen, pondered over by the mind, all that I have fully understood, all that is known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken his stand upon it. If I were to say, whatsoever in the world, etc., all that I do not know, that would be a falsehood in me. If I were to say, I both know it and know it not, that would be a falsehood in me. If I were to say, I neither know it nor know it not, that would be a fault in me as well. Thus, bhikkhus, the Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight. He does not conceive of an unseen. He does not conceive of a thing to be seen. He does not conceive about a seer. He does not conceive of an audible, a sound, a thing to be sensed, a thing to be cognized, a cognizable thing apart from cognition. He does not conceive of an uncognized. He does not conceive of a thing worth cognizing. He does not conceive about one who cognizes. Thus, bhikkhus, the Tathagata, being such like, tadi, in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, sensed and cognized, is thus, tata. Moreover, there is none other greater or more excellent than one who is thus, I declare. Whatever seen, heard, sensed or clung to is known as truth by other folk. Amidst those who are entrenched in views, one thus holds none as true or false. The barb which hooks, impales the world, has been discerned well in advance. I know, I see, this is the truth. Tathagatas do not cling thus. The terms thing worth seeing, hearing, cognizing, etc., are pointing to the habit that we have of imputing inherent value or substance to perceptions, thoughts, and emotions. Without such imputation, they do not possess any such solidity or worth. So Lumpu Cha's teachings, one of the Dhamma talks, he talks about, in the teachings they talk about mind-attended things and non-mind-attended things. And then he expounds on that. We tend to say, well, you know, there's a microphone here. And if I'm not paying attention to it, then the microphone still exists. Well, something's still going on, but calling it a microphone and naming it in that way and imputing a thingness to it, that's coming from my mind or our minds. It's not coming from this object. And so from its own side, it's not a microphone. And these are obviously quite subtle terms. A thing to be seen. So the thingness, the separate objectness, is coming from our minds. It doesn't mean to say that it's all a dream or that it's totally imagined, but that making this into a separate thing and calling it microphone is coming from our minds. From its own side, what scale do you measure it on? From the level of quarks? From the level of the galaxy? How big is this? It's this size, Ajahn. Because we measure things by our human scale, but how do you measure it? On the level of subatomic particles? On the level of the galaxies or the whole cosmos? How big is it? How small is it? On ordinary everyday realities, we don't consider things in that way, but this is the kind of area that the Buddha is speaking about, not conceiving of a visible thing apart from sight, or an unseen. The thing is still there if we don't see it. Well, doesn't mean the four elements don't keep happening, but the mind giving it its quality. In one of Lumpu Cha's Dhamma talks, he speaks about this very profound state of meditation that he experienced in his Tudong years, living alone, I think in an abandoned monastery he was staying in for some time. He said, there was a kettle, but it wasn't a kettle. There was a spittoon, but it wasn't a spittoon. It wasn't anything else, but the mind stopped giving it that value or that substance, that thingness. That's what Bhikkhu Nyanananda is talking about here. He says, thingness has completely faded away. These are subtle areas of philosophy, but what he's talking about is that whatever seen, heard, or sensed, or clung to is known as truth. Like, I see the carpet, I see this building, I see you. And that's taken as true and real and solid. That's known as truth by other folk. Amidst those who are entrenched in views, one thus holds none as true or false. So that when the mind is in accord with Dhamma, when there's true clarity, true wisdom, then it's not imputing that false thingness or solidity. The barb, like a fishing hook, the barb which hooks and impales the world has been discerned well in advance. I know, I see, this is the truth. Tathagatas do not cling thus. The terms thing worth seeing, hearing, cognizing, etc., pointing to the habit we have of imputing inherent value or substance to perceptions, thoughts, and emotions. Without such imputation, they do not possess any such solidity or worth. Tradition has it that 500 of those listening to this very short Dhamma talk, that's the whole sutta, it's very, very short, but 500 of those listening attained arahantship, and there were 5 earthquakes during the course of the exposition. This short teaching also became of great significance in the centuries after the Buddha's time. It was used by the elder Maharakita under the auspices of King Ashoka's missionary endeavors to instruct the Yonikas, the Greeks, in their home country. Ashoka sent out missionaries from India to many places, including to Europe, and Yonika, Y-O-N-A-K-A, like Ionia, the word for the Greek civilization. Apparently there was some of Ashoka's missionaries reached the Yonikas, the Greeks in the Mediterranean, and this was the theme that Venerable Maharakita used as his main teaching. So it is said. So any final questions, comments? Yes.
Yes, Ajahn. I'm sort of perplexed and just like baffled with defining and understanding the term like suchness or thusness, ta-ta-ta, if you would be able to communicate what does it actually mean.
It's like this.
Yeah.
Precisely because of in so many of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings, he'll say, Dhamma is unimaginable. You try to think of the unconditioned and the mind goes quiet. You try to imagine timelessness and it's unimaginable because our language and our thinking is based on sensory experience. And so inevitably the capacity of language to express that which is beyond sensory experience, which is timeless, which is unformed, unconditioned, the language is very hard-pressed concept to accurately represent those qualities. So words like isness or suchness, and over the years, Lumpur Sumedho is saying, you know, it's like this, or this is the way it is. He's been saying it for 40 years or more. He's been using that kind of phrase. But it's really using words to lead the mind to that quality of presence, so that there's awareness and an attunement of the mind, the heart, to its own nature, to Dhamma, but not creating a concept or a word around that, not forming any structures. I often quote the dialogue between the Buddha and Vajragotha, where he says, you know, that one trying to define the Tathagata in terms of the five khandhas, they can't do that. It's impossible, because the Tathagata is liberated from being reckoned in terms of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And then he says, he is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the great ocean. So there's a presence as a quality, but you can't describe it in ordinary terms. So it's not connected to the five khandhas, it's not connected to time or location. It's akaliko, timeless, asankata, abhutang, you know, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed. So using words like profound, immeasurable, unfathomable can kind of refer to that, but they can't really describe or encapsulate that quality. So it's naturally a wordless realization or a wordless appreciation, a wordless realization of that quality. Would you?
Well, one of the things also, just to come at it from a different angle, when you say like suchness or thusness, to me it's also pointing to something like when we refer to the Dhamma as santitiko, apparent here and now. It is a here and now experience that is just like this, rather than over analyzing it or over conceiving it. It's kind of like this, it's apparent here and now.
This is the way it is. Yes, last one.
Can you say, why do you go out and order the pots?
You can perfectly, yeah, reasonably say that. Yeah. Trickier than sound, but equally, if not more important. Okay, so let's leave it there for today.